I remember Jason Sudeikis got up at award ceremony. He gotten all these awards for Ted Lasso, yeah. And he's like, you know, it's funny. He's like, he said, we win all these awards. He goes, making the show about two things Americans hate, you know, soccer and kindness. Did I screw that up?
And you can get Listen Up for only
$14. Hey, we're back.
We're back, John. You're back. We're back.
I'm back. And you didn't go anywhere.
I did in the middle of summer, but...
Did you really?
I did.
Where'd you go?
I went to Seattle, to south of Seattle, Gig Harbor, but I drove...
That's a big summer getaway. You drove to Seattle?
I drove and camped along the way with one of my boys, and then we were there, and then I came back, and I went a different route and drove all the way back and camped. And I spent time in Montana and Wyoming... I'd never been there. Beautiful. Wasn't Scotland, but it was beautiful. I'd never seen that.
No, that's awesome. Matt Russell does vacations. I would never, I'm just going to take off and camp.
I basically became a long-haul trucker for about 2.5 weeks.
No, I would take off, and I would look on the maps, like, where's the Marriott? Exactly. You know? I would stop along the way.
But you had some grand adventure. I mean, this is like your first vacation in about 30 years, right? I mean...
No. Not first vacation. But I mean, no, I did take extended summer.
Yeah, because like last summer, was nothing.
No, the last couple... Yeah, last couple of years. I don't know if you got the memo. It's a lot going on. But yeah, the committees here, my staff parish committee here at Chapwood was really great. They said, we want you to take a lot of time this summer.
Yeah, breathe.
It's like, okay, whatever. I've never taken a sabbatical. I didn't call it a sabbatical, even though I was gone for 2.5 months.
Most people don't come back from sabbaticals.
Well, that's the reason
why. I didn't call it a sabbatical, John.
Because at Chapelwood, people who take sabbaticals either come back and quit, or they come back and leave, or they come back and retire. So I can't retire.
No.
I mean, I could.
No.
If someone would want to pay me to retire. I don't think I want to quit.
No.
I will say it's interesting when you're gone that amount of time. Mm-hmm. I really disconnected, turned off email, or at least, put on the out of office thing and really try to like the first month is just like detoxing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause my wife is like, are you going to do something productive? I said, well, that's the whole counter of Sabbath. The whole point of Sabbath is I don't have to produce anything. She goes, you got to do something.
So we're cleaning out the garage now, right, John?
Little thing, but just to decompress and disconnect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I honestly, the first month I would say it's just rest.
Mm.
You kind of feel bad cause you're like, I should be doing something. Mm. Productive, but Barbara Brown Taylor talks about that.
Yeah.
You know, it takes you a long time to unplug, even if you're used to taking a weekly Sabbath or whatever. Like disconnecting like that, it's just not natural.
Hmm.
Then the second month, I was kind of like, okay, I need to start thinking about being productive. And I started reading, read a couple of good books.
What'd you read?
We'll talk about that on future podcasts.
Okay. All right.
Because I'm kind of hoping maybe we could get like some of the authors on.
Oh, that'd be great.
I'm trying. But, you know, they're famous people.
Wow.
And we're just us.
But we're fun people. They want to talk to us.
We are. So it was good. And then I, towards the end, I started thinking about, you know, trying to get in better shape, getting back in the gym. And I started fasting, intermittent fasting. So there's like a lot of things that are going on. I've lost some weight. I'm not anywhere where I need to be. I still wear a coat to cover up my... splotchy pointers. But had a grandson this summer.
That's
May 30th.
He's beautiful.
I sent Jeff some pictures. His name is Henry.
He's beautiful, dude. I saw him Sundays ago. I just
You know how they always say, like, oh, all babies are cute. All babies are not cute.
No, they're not.
But this baby's cute.
This baby's super cute.
He's cute. It was so funny because when my daughter and son-in-law, they named him, they did the reveal, and they already had the name, which I think was smart because then the family didn't have to negotiate, help name the child.
Mm. Yeah,
and so then it's, you know, it's going to be Henry Wade, you know, is his, and his, my son-in-law's grandparents were there. They're from England.
Okay.
From Leicester, England. And she came up and said, "It's not too late to change it to Harry." And both my daughters and son are like, "It's Henry. We already named it." She goes, "Because you still have time." To Henry, to Harry. I guess it's more of a royal name.
Yeah.
So you had a grandbaby. That was the first month of resting was. It's a lot of.
So
lot
this of, is your first grandchild.
First grandkid.
What's that? I mean, I haven't even talked to you really since that.
That's great.
What's it like?
Yeah, everybody says it's great. It's great.
Is it great?
Yeah. Because you get to hold them and they eat and they sleep and they coo and then they go home. And you don't have to wake up with them at night and you don't have to change diaper or, you know.
Sarah Mac looks really tired and really happy.
I would imagine that's true of all. Oh, there he is.
Look at him. Look at him. Just beautiful. It's amazing.
He's a cutie pie.
He's tall. He looks long, at least.
That's probably the camera. No, he's long. He's good. Yeah, so he went to England as well just this week.
Oh, really?
They just got back yesterday. Wow. Because my son-in-law's grandparents, his grandfather has been ill, and so they wanted him to meet Henry. So they went over, and he did great. He traveled on the plane. You know, he does better than me. He slept on the plane the whole way. Then he gets home. They get home like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then he goes to bed, and he sleeps all night. I'm like, I can't even do that. Hey, he's a better traveler than I am. It's awesome.
Real old men and real young kids.
Yeah, I mean, I can't sleep on the plane, and then I'm up at 3 in the morning. And but yeah, this is good. And then, you know, we did a couple of little trips here and there. But big dream, selfish trip was we just got back last week. I went to Scotland to play golf, and that was I was like a big bucket list. I'm not old enough to like bucket list is like I think of like at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't wait until I couldn't play golf anymore.
Yeah.
So, no, it was fun. It was really good. We went with a group of 16 of us. Got to hear the bagpipes play. Got to hear...
how many days?
There's the bagpipes.
Oh, wow. Looked like it was actually sunny for part of your trip,
too. It was. It was like 65 and sunny, like, every day. Wow. We had, like, just a little rain. It's gorgeous.
Fantastic.
I don't get bagpipes.
Might be the most annoying instrument.
So when we were sitting outside,
it's kind of the banjo of.
All right, so we're sitting outside. So that's Trump Turnberry Hotel. Now, listen, I don't care where you are in your politics. I'm gonna tell you something.
Man can make a hotel.
That dude can do a hotel.
He can do it, really?
Yes,
like, what do you mean by that?
You want to stay there?
Is it sweet?
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
Really?
Oh yeah, it is.
Just very, like
because you know in Europe when you travel in Europe. 5-star for Europe or whatever is not like 5-star.
Crappy hotel.
Anybody who has ever been overseas, just different. I mean, older buildings and everything. That place is nice.
Really?
Yeah, but we're sitting on there. We're having cocktails before we went down to have dinner, which was down at the bottom of that hill in another building. And so this bagpiper, he's standing there and he's tuning the bagpipe, you know.
Which doesn't really help it.
Which sounds not anything different than when he's playing the bagpipe. He's tuning the thing. He's going, like, what is he doing? Oh, he's tuning it. Now, tuning it is just, he's just playing it. So yeah, it's Turnberry. It's gorgeous. There's a little lighthouse out there.
It's Turnberry. Is it an old building that had been refurbished?
Yes, okay. Yes. It was an old, I don't know the exact history. Some people probably know, but yeah, it was an old, like either a castle or a fortress or something, but it's been renovated and redone and, man, it's really, really nice. They've had a couple of open championships there, which are the big, you know, major championships, but it's really nice, really nice.
That's great.
So, yeah, we're back, and...
It's good to have you back. We missed you, bro.
Yeah, I thought I'd just come back and have an episode to talk about my grandbaby and my golf, which would be interesting to absolutely no one. Yeah, we have been off for a while.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think as we move back in this morning when we met for staff worship, we were just talking about, you know, discipleship and what it means to be the church and kind of reaching out. We're going to have, you know, we got a lot of guests we're going to have on and talk about kind of faith in the world that we live in.
Yeah.
It's difficult days, right?
Right.
But I was reading, I shared this morning, I read an article that's actually going to come out in The Atlantic. in September. I think I sent it to you guys. And it's by David Brooks. I think you can read it if you're online, but it's called How America Got Mean. It was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And it fits so many, I don't know, it fits so many boxes of things that I've been thinking about this summer of what does it mean to be the church? What does it mean to be a moral community in the midst of so much anger and sadness and resentment and tribalism?
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? It seems like everybody's at each other's throats.
Yes.
And even Christianity, churches against churches, and even people in their own churches against fellow church members over all sorts of things. And what I thought, if just for today, just for a few minutes as we kind of get started back on doing podcasts, I got to stretch my legs. I don't remember how to do this. I came back in and I was like, I had to remember how to work all this stuff.
How do burp I? Button. The burp button.
No, I forgot I have a mute button. Okay. But you know, the good news is the intermittent fasting thing, I don't have nearly the post-lunch gaseousness that I used to when I
thank the Lord
scarved.
Huh? Yeah, what's your fasting window?
So
from 9 to 10 a.m.
4 days a week I do a 16:8. So like yesterday I stopped at 7:30 and was able to eat. I ate at noon today. Like so, like 8 to noon. It's like 16 hours, and it's your fat burning.
You get into some good fat burning.
Good fat burning. Yeah. Right? Yeah. So from what I have read, and I'm a newbie to this, but like. You know, that's interesting about the Bible's filled with fasting.
Yes.
And I always knew that. I always did it from a spiritual, prayerful perspective. But as I'm kind of like learning about fasting and reading about it and like watching YouTube videos, which is how anyone learns anything.
Yeah.
About it.
The new Bible.
I mean, the science behind this stuff is
crazy.
Fascinating.
Crazy.
Do you know a lot about it?
Crazy good. Well, I've just started. You and I talked just briefly about it. I've been reading a book by Peter Attia.
Oh, Attia, yeah.
Called Outlive, and he just
that book. That's one that I've
you'll love
just
it.
Started.
You'll
and
love it.
Everyone has recommended it as well.
You'll
Outlive,
love it. And he does a lot of stuff both with kind of neurobiology, psychology, emotions, and like the mind body,
whole health
stuff.
But not like what I kind of talk voodoo medicine.
No,
real.
This is an MD. This is a research scientist.
Yeah. But yeah, the fasting thing, like I've watched these videos of guys who even fast like 3 days or 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like kills off or sloughs off all like the dead cell material and all that. I had no idea all this stuff worked that way.
Yeah.
You know, you think you're just losing weight, but there's actually some cleansing kind of stuff. So that makes sense that it's wired into the scripture as a way of purifying yourself or preparing yourself to listen to God. It's not just about hunger pains, right?
Right.
It's about kind of cleansing yourself, preparing yourself.
Right.
And I feel good. I mean, you don't eat as much when you're in that 16:8 window. So during the 8 hours that you can eat, it says like, well, you can eat whatever you want. So when I got back from Scotland, I didn't really adhere to it in Scotland because we're walking like 500 miles a day, like Sherpa sheep through the Scottish countryside. So I just ate. But when I got back, I fasted the first day and it got to be noon. And I said, let's go to El Tiempo. I need Tex-Mex. I need queso. Because all I've had was like blood sausage and haggis and
you know, you did not eat haggis.
Oh yeah, that's good. It's okay.
It's not okay.
Oh, even the Scottish people, the caddies are. I was like haggis. You're like, oh, I hate haggis. Oh, I hate haggis. Haggis is the worst.
It's
the worst.
It's like intestine.
They don't like it.
No.
So I get back and I go. So here's what you don't do when you're intermittent fasting: is that first meal you eat 3 pounds of queso, 4 enchiladas, taco, because then you go home and you feel like somebody injected
you
with
food,
like
baby, for the next 4 days.
Some kind of silicone that expands in your belly. It's like really, really, really bad. So I've learned to be, so you don't eat as many calories in that 8 hour window too, which is another thing that's beneficial. But all right, so we got all sidetracked. Thank you for the.
You got it.
All right, we're going to do a health podcast.
We're going to have to
where we just kind of make stuff up. Now, I heard this is really healthy.
I think if you
inject the queso straight into your veins. So I think that's so anyway, David Brooks has read this article and he talks about, we know that our society is sadder, right? There's rising drugs, alcohol, suicide. He goes through all of this stuff of rising hopelessness, persistent feelings of sad. But he says his second question related is, why have Americans become so mean?
Yeah.
And what he unpacks here, he says, as far as extreme meanness, he's like, hate crimes have risen, murder rates are surging, gun sales are up, social trust is plummeting. In 2000, two-thirds of Americans gave to charity, but in 2018, fewer than half gave to charity. And the words that define our age are conspiracy, polarization, mass shootings, trauma, safe spaces. And so he goes on to talk about, well, why is this the case? He goes, well, there's the technology part of this, the social media. There's the sociological, we don't participate in community organizations quite the way we used to.
The bowling alone.
The bowling alone. Okay. Or even the SAS, the Senator, the Them book. The demography story. You know, we've long been a white-dominated nation, becoming more diverse. That creates some panic among certain groups of people. The economy story, economic inequality. And he says all of these things are a part of it, and they're all contribute to it. But what he said is the most important thing that he's found, or at least what they see in the data, why Americans have become sad, alienated, and rude, is also the simplest reason. And he says it is because we inhabit a society in which people are no longer trained in how to treat one another with kindness and consideration. Now, the article is really, really long. It's almost like a research paper. And he goes through a lot of history about how we used to do moral formation.
Yes.
Character, teaching of character in curriculum and schools, and that after World War II, that sort of got stripped away with the psychology movement and sort of became very much self-referenced, hyper-individualized, all this sort of stuff that we got away from the teaching of moral formation or moral character. And so when he says moral formation, it sounds like stuffy, but he says it's really three things. He said, first, we used to help people to learn to restrain their selfishness. How do we keep our evolutionarily conferred egotism under control? Hmm. And part of what he would argue is that in recent decades, we've not really worked to help people restrain their selfishness. Second, teaching basic social and ethical skills. How do you welcome a new neighbor into your community? How do you disagree with someone constructively? We don't teach people that anymore.
No.
I give a great example. So I have a liberal arts education, right? I was a history major, which is the most useless degree in the world. No offense to history majors. I am one, but you have to have another degree or go do something in banking. All right.
Yes.
Or whatever. I mean, but a liberal arts education, I minored in philosophy and religious studies. It teaches you how to think about lots of different perspectives.
Right.
And so when you have a conversation with someone, sometimes you're willing to say, well, I may not know the answer to that question. And I learned that sometimes when I'm having conversations with people who do not have liberal arts backgrounds, sort of professional specified kind of degrees like accounting or whatever, you know, you'll start talking about something that has nothing to do with accounting and nothing to do with history, right? Just pick any subject. And I'm not just saying it's me, but like the liberal arts person would say, well, I've heard this as a cop, you know, this could be an option, or this could be, or this could be, or this could be, but you know, maybe there's more to the story. And the other person's like, no, it's this way. This is the only way. I'm like, you don't even know anything about this, but the hubris of like, I read something somewhere or I believe something somewhere and that's it.
Yes.
Whereas I'm willing to say, well, I could be wrong. And the guy goes, yeah, you are wrong. So the point of it is like...
That really opens up the conversation, doesn't it? It asks for a lot more curiosity.
So you think it's just about some like nondescript, like non-controversial subject that you're talking about. Can you imagine if it was really a controversial subject? Hmm. And how do you disagree with someone in a constructive, life-giving way? We're not trained to do that anymore. in school, and it's kind of one of the arguments. And 30 says, is helping people find purpose in life. And what he said was, for many generations, we had morally formative institutions that held up certain sets of ideals. And they provided practical pathways toward meaningful existence. So, for example, here's how you can dedicate your life to serving the poor, protecting the nation, loving your neighbor. That's what Brooks said. And he said, even if you read the Founding Fathers, they had a low view of human nature, and they designed the Constitution to sort of protect against that. Benjamin Franklin wrote, men, I find to be a sort of beings very badly constructed, as they are generally more easily provoked than reconciled, more disposed to do mischief to each other than to make reparation, and much more easily deceived than undeceived.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in the early days of our country, think about colleges, universities, schools, churches, social organizations, community organizations, they all had some character building component, moral instruction. It wasn't just read and write and arithmetic, right? It wasn't just intellectual knowledge that you were learning. You also, like, remember they used to teach you like a cotillion, how to sit at a table, which fork to use, how to ask a girl to dance. There were certain things that some people in society do now, but you don't have those if you think about what we teach in school. Those things were a part of our structure and system, and they aren't really anymore. And think about churches used to be that as well, but now churches are almost like doctrine factories.
Right? Policing the borders of their own thought life.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, and so a lot of churches are teaching pure doctrine, but not teaching people how to love one another,
right.
How to love your enemies,
right.
How to do good to those who do evil to you. And so I just found it fascinating.
Jesus really didn't say that, John. Let me tell you what he meant.
Well, you know, interestingly,
there's a lot of that going around, right?
Interestingly enough, there's now a segment of certain people that are defined as evangelical in our country, or Christian in our country, in term only, from like a political definition.
Yes.
That if that will basically tell you the Sermon on the Mount is not appropriate or applicable anymore. Mm. It doesn't fit in the days in which we live. It's just too, that's just too woke. Right? Turn the other cheek and all that. That doesn't work now because the bad guys are after us, and you can't do that.
Yeah. Right. Can I ask a question about this article, since we're talking about it? There's a part of me that wants to push back against this a little, as much as I love David Brooks and his work, in that, like you and I grew up in a somewhat of a different era where this was taught to us, right? We learned these moral things. We learned, to hold the door open. We learned liberal education. We learned to have conversations, I think, where it wasn't a zero-sum game. Is that correct?
His argument in this article would be that it was a long process post-World War II, that even though you may have been taught, society as a whole in America lost the moral teaching in all these different...
But it feels like in the last 5 years, there's been a massive, maybe 10 years, a massive precipitous decline in our civility towards each other, and what David Brooks describes as tribalism and us and them and all, right? Mm-hmm. It feels like that now is something that has been totally eclipsed in some ways.
So in a way, he addresses that. Like I said, it's really worth the read because he does build a long, I think, historical case as to the post-World War II, particularly the psychological, sociological, cultural changes that happened that kind of slowly took away the moral skills, not across the board, but generally speaking for most people. And then what he gets to says, when you have, for example, the breakdown of a moral framework in society, when you start having, you haven't taught, so his thesis, okay, and you can argue this because it's he's putting it out there. Yeah. You can certainly argue with him. But his thesis is that because of we've lost the teaching of moral formation, All right. It's been a breakdown, at least. You just call it a breakdown of moral formation.
Okay.
He says what that does is it has created disconnection.
Okay.
It's created alienation. It's created estrangement from people around you. And this guy, who's a theologian at Duke Divinity School, Luke Bretherton, sort of made this statement. And the result, he said, is a kind of sadness that you see in people around you. Young adults who are spiraling, leaving school, moving from one mental health facility to another. A woman said, what do you do when you no longer want to be alive? I mean, I think people listening to this podcast could just think, not only maybe they're in a good personal space, but I'll bet they know people that are really struggling to say, you know, alienated, disconnected, estranged, or feeling estranged. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at the stats, suicide rates increased 30% since 2000.
Wow.
And then he says, sadness, loneliness, self-harm turn into bitterness. Social pain is ultimately a response to a sense of rejection, of being invisible, unheard, disrespected, and victimized.
Yeah.
And when people feel that their identity is unrecognized, their experience registers as an injustice. He says, because it is an injustice.
Yes.
It is an injustice.
Yes.
People who've been treated unjustly then begin to lash out and seek ways to humiliate those who they believe have humiliated them. Now we start getting into our modern tribalism, separating into groups.
Just ripping each other apart.
Because what he says is, and politics is one of the things that have filled that, ideology, names that we sort of attach to ourselves. It could even be evangelical. That could be one of the tribes in a sense. But what he makes this huge long argument about how politics has filled a sense of void that give people a sense of righteousness. And now their moral stance is not based on their conduct, but on their location along a political spectrum. Make sense?
Yes.
And so you don't have to be good. You just have to be A, which it, you fill in the blank, whatever your political...
Aligned with whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm victimized. Think about now how, even in politics, how everybody is the victim. Everybody's being victimized, right? Because if you claim the victim status, then you're more virtuous in whatever it is that you say or do, because you are being put upon. It's injustice to you.
Yes.
What's happening to you.
Yes.
And so it provides us with now a sense of purpose, because... There was one of the parts where he said that in 1967, like 85% of the people who were coming into college, if you ask them, like, you know, what's ultimately your goal in life? And they say, I want to be a good, productive member of society, kind of a good person. That would be what they say. And now it's like 80% of people, well, I want to be wealthy. I want to be successful. I want to be fill in the blank, you know, but not, it's shifted from 1967 to 2022.
Yeah.
And so now that sort of like, I want to be someone who contributes to the greater good, to I want to make a lot of money and I want to be successful. So it's fascinating.
Are there places, John, where these kinds of energies have taken hold in a place, a society, a community, and they have in some ways been, and I don't mean this in a charismatic necessarily way, but have been exercised, that where the ship is turned around, where there's been a counter narrative that's come and said, actually, you know, this spirit of the age is anti to what Jesus and humanity is.
Yeah. So he gives two,
okay,
sort of anecdotal illustrations of sort of in the culture, even in dark times, the sparks of renewal show up.
Yeah.
And so he said in 2018,
okay,
the Mr. Rogers documentary,
yeah, okay,
you know, Won't You Be My Neighbor, was released. And he said this film showed, you know, Fred Rogers in all his just goodness, small acts of generosity, vulnerability, respect, reverence for every child. And he's like, people are in the movie theaters. They go watch this either at home or in the movie theater, and people are weeping out loud watching this.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And I remember that.
You remember, it just kind of made a huge impact.
Yeah.
People were like, you got to watch this. And because it was like, I see goodness.
Yeah.
in the midst of everything else. And the other example he gives, which is one we probably really enjoy together, and it kind of uniquely came during the pandemic when we were all isolated.
I know where you're going.
And it was on Apple TV, right, is Ted Lasso. Yeah. And I remember Jason Sudeikis got up at an awards ceremony. He'd gotten all these awards for Ted Lasso. Yeah. And he's like, you know, it's funny. He's like, he said, we win all these awards. He goes, making the show about two things Americans hate. You know, soccer and kindness.
Kindness. You know, we're going to do a series at The Crossing called The Gospel According to Ted Lasso.
Oh, my God. I think that's great.
Yeah. There's so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. But even in the midst of him confronting, if you've watched Ted Lasso, he confronts his own fears.
Absolutely.
His own brokenness.
Yes.
His own stuff where he's breaking down.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, I mean, he's gentle. He's wise.
Yes.
He's vulnerable.
Yeah.
And he helps people to grow in the best version of themselves. I mean, in a sense, those are two examples of moral formation or maybe a light in the midst of where we don't
darkness.
See it on a regular basis. I mean, there was I had a guy recently who I know that runs a restaurant, and he's like, you know, every week I have to ask somebody to leave.
Mm.
It's like, I never used to have to do that.
Just because people are being
mean. Mm. I just got to ask somebody to leave like every week.
You know, it's interesting, John, when kindness becomes prophetic utterance against darkness, we know that something's wrong, right? When just the act of being kind is something that resisting something. I think what the scripture says, don't overcome evil with evil, right? But overcome evil with goodness, with kindness, I think that's the thing, what you were saying even this morning as a staff, that we have to reclaim as a church. And it's very simple but difficult in a world that is now valuing, like, you know, money, and there's a sense of victimhood and desperation and all these things that are at a fever pitch, to come back into a community and say, no, we got you. God's got us, and we can respond differently, whether it's in a checkout line or with our kids or whatever. You know, and here's some spiritual practices that will enable that, I think is going to be really...
Yeah, I think a lot of it is working with people one-on-one, intentionality. I was talking with a guy a couple of weeks ago who's just dealing with anger issues.
Mm.
And it was an awakening for him just to think about, like, journaling, like to figure out what the triggers were.
Yeah.
Like, he'd never thought about thinking about during the day how he got so angry, and began to, you know, I said, just write those moments down, begin to capture those moments. It's just awareness, right?
Yeah.
And so we think about, that ought to be something that all of us learn at some point.
Yeah.
Things like, you know, being kind to one another and becoming more self-aware about our lives. And I don't think that's something that a lot of people are, you know, deal with really well, or at least... You know, like I said, it's an interesting article. I think for churches, particularly in the world that we live in, or religious faith communities, part of when we talk about discipleship, we're talking about being learners and being formed. And we've talked about at Chapelwood a lot. We want to be about not just the words, but the way, you know, of Jesus. We'll follow the words, the way, the actions, the movements.
Yeah.
Of Jesus. So it's one of the reasons why I've not been able to, some people want me to condemn certain groups of people, right? And I'm like, well, you show me in the New Testament where Jesus condemns people, and I'll start doing that.
But
he doesn't do that.
No.
And so I can't do that if that's not the way Jesus does. And the other thing is, how can I walk away from the table when Jesus goes and sits at the table with the people who the religious establishment refused to sit at the table with? And so when you see churches split and there's certain groups like, well, we're going to leave because you're not willing to either condemn certain groups or you're not willing to include certain groups of people at the table. You know, well, you can say whatever you think about what it means to include someone at the table, but you can't say no one's welcome at the table when Jesus sits at the table with sinners and tax collectors.
Yes.
He eats and drinks with them.
Yeah.
And he was condemned by the Pharisees for it. And so you have to reconcile yourself with that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to reconcile yourself with Paul's teaching in Corinthians that no matter whether you disagree with people, whether they be other Christians or whatever, you can't be unkind. Mm-hmm. You can't lack gentleness. You know, you can't lose your self-control.
Yes.
Your witness, the means, is just as important as the end.
That's right. I love when I took that Dietrich Bonhoeffer class in seminary. It's one of the things that Dietrich Bonhoeffer defines as sin is the walking away from community. It's kind of basically taking your toys and saying, I'm going to pick my idea over relationship. Right. And he says, really, if the two or three are gathered in the name of Jesus, that's where the actual presence of Jesus is. Then we have to be able to work those out in community. And I think that's something that has shaped me to my core, mm-hmm. that we can't walk away from each other. I may not agree with you or other people, but you're my brother, you're my sister. We're going to work this out together. This is family.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And if we can't do this here as a church, then we're mimicking the way that the world is going to our own destruction and demise.
Yeah, I reread Douglas Campbell's book on Paul.
Yeah.
Because we're going to go to Greece next spring with the trip. And I mean, it stood out to me. You know, Paul was not a moralist. He was a mystic.
Yes.
And we think of Paul as a moralist. No. You know, he's about all the rules and regulations. No. And he really wasn't. He was about unity and community and trying to hold tension together.
Yes.
And it's good to go back and read Corinthians again and get a sense of that. Well, last thing I'll say, so this Sunday I'm going to be preaching on the story where Jesus escapes from his parents. He's 12 years old. They're at the Passover tent.
Freaks his parents out.
And he runs away, right? And they can't find him. There's a lot of just basic family drama. Like if you've ever lost your child in a grocery store, you know this story.
Or been lost.
Yeah, exactly. And they find him in the temple, right, area. And he's been there for a couple days, you know. And they're mad. And I just always think it's like they're looking for him everywhere. They're looking for him.
He's already on
the caravan. And finally they get to him, find him there in the temple. And I love what Mary, she said, she calls him child. And it says he's 12, which means he's kind of an adult now. She says, child, this is a mother thing, right? Why did you do this to us? Is her comment. I love that because I'm thinking Mary speaks for all of us.
Yes.
And he says, why, I can't remember exactly how I said it, but he's like, you know, why would you be concerned or why would you think I'm where I'm supposed to be? I've been in my father's house. I mean, why would you think anything else?
Where else would I be?
Where else would I have been? And one of the first things that stood out to me was like in society to now, especially Christians, I think people who are spiritual and Christian, it's like, we expect Jesus to be with us on our agenda, on our issues, mm-hmm. and our ideology, to be on the, because we're on the right side, Jesus on our side. Mm-hmm. We're on the Jesus side.
That's right.
And sometimes I wonder if we're looking, you know, Jesus is not really with us. He is in a different place. And if we could ever really stop ourselves to open up, we'd realize He's over here, not where we are.
Yeah.
I think it's true of all of us. I think we all have to have a bit of humility to think that he's not going to be where I am just because I think I'm right.
Yes. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. In the 12 steps, they call that the fourth step is like doing an inventory, a moral and fearless inventory. And I think that spiritually, that's the same question you're asking there, is like, is my agenda God's agenda, or is it, have I just baptized the name of God into my own agenda so that I can do whatever the heck I want to anyway? You know, and so everybody else, it's what is Anne Lamott says, it's a funny thing when God hates everybody that you hate as well.
You that's know? Not God.
That's not God.
That's a God created in your image.
Yes.
When it just so happens to be convenient that all of your enemies are the enemies of God.
Yes.
Then you have crafted God in your image.
Yeah. First commandment. You've already made an image.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. Rachel Shreddy sent me after this morning, she said, it reminded me of this thing about Henry Nouwen. And she said, it said, after nearly two decades of teaching at academic institutions, including the University of Notre Dame, Yale Divinity School, Harvard Divinity School. Henry Nouwen went on to work with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities at the L'Arche Daybreak community in Richmond Hill, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And it said, and that's where he found Jesus.
Yeah.
Not in the theology schools.
No.
Not in the divinity schools. Not in the academia.
Same with Paul, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's awesome.
I think all of us as leaders in this world, where fewer people want to go to church, fewer people want to be organized, identified with organized religion. I am an institutional pastor in an organized religion, and I totally get it.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree. I mean, I think the organized institutional church has failed in many ways, stopped being a community of moral formation around the embodiment of Jesus.
Yes.
And we had to be right. You know, we had to win through power and means of cozying up with the powers and the principalities. And
that's right.
And I think that's a big mistake that we have made and are still making.
Yes.
And we have to figure out how to do something different.
Yeah.
It's the only way I think people are going to really ever want to be connected to church anymore.
Yeah.
I think they want to be connected to Christ, the real Christ, the one who's at his Father's house doing what he's supposed to be doing, the one who you see in the Gospels.
Yeah.
That people are like, I get that, but I don't see that in any churches.
Right. Right. That's why when we see Christ show up, give me a little rope here. When we see Christ show up in Ted Lasso, when we see Christ show up in Mr. Rogers, the film, mm-hmm. we think, oh, I want more of that. That's what I'm hungry for.
Yeah.
And I wonder as we continue to surrender what we're doing here and innovate and think through that thing about what it means to instantiate that kind of community at Chapelwood. I think people are hungry. I'm hungry for that. I want to be a part of a community and pastoring alongside of you in a community that's like attempting to do that. I'll give my freaking life to that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we need something to get some energy,
some
passion to come back from sabbatical.
I'm glad you're back, dude. We missed you.
Hey, well, we're back. The podcast, we're going to be here every week for a while doing something. We'll have some good content for you every week. But make sure you go, and it always helps if you subscribe, whatever platform, whether you're on YouTube or Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you subscribe, then you get notification. If you like it, that helps.
Yep.
You know, if you give a rating or you leave a rating or whatever, that always helps. It pushes it up. We're at like 100 million episodes now, aren't we, Jeff? Yeah. It's well over 100, but I don't know. 150. Wow.
Dear Lord.
Over 100,000 plays. That's nice.
That's all right. It's not all your mother either.
A lot of them are. Damn, she just played it. I listened to that one 5 times yesterday.
She's her own bot farm.
She's a bot farm.
John's mom's a bot farm.
But it does help. And the other thing you can do, the other thing you can do is if you, it's called Bot Farm.
John's mom's a bot farm is the name of the episode.
The other thing you can do is, you know, make sure you share with friends, family members, especially if there's an episode that speaks to you. I think this one today is interesting. If nothing else, I'm not putting David Brooks out there to say he's right about every single thing he's saying. I just think, man, this is a good conversation starter.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I do think that he's picking up on some things about particularly moral formation that when he says it, I'm like, oh, I see that.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I think so.
Which I think is good. So, anything good for the order before we go, Jeff?
Like and subscribe.
I think I said that already. I could say it at the beginning.
You did. It's great.
And I did get my Scottish accent. Make sure you're making sure you roll your R's. You got to roll your R's a little bit.
That sounds good, John.
He said, make sure you hit this putt firm.
Firm.
Hit the putt firm.
I love it.
All right, well, This has been fun. It's good to be back. I'm a little, I'm finding my way around still. So we'll be back next week. I'm John Stevens.
And I'm Matt Russell.
And this is Pod Have Mercy.